Midterm is on Thursday, so today we're going to give a wrap up. Midterm is on Thursday. So today we're going to give a wrap up of the course so far and then answer questions or whatever on of you've gotten. We've done the first two parts of the course, on demand and supply and price and applications, and case studies of intervention, government intervention into the price system. Okay. We started with the law of diminishing margin utility. In other words, that given the greater this is utility on the y-axis and this is quantity, the greater the supply of a good, the lower the utility of each unit. That's the law of diminishing margin utility. So that if you, this solves the value paradox. In other words, the idea, how come that water, even though it's extremely important for life, or bread, which is important for life, is very cheap. On the other hand, diamonds, which are a mere luxury and frippery, are very expensive. That's the famous value paradox. Solved by concentrating on the unit. In other words, that the people do not evaluate the entire supply of bread or water or diamonds for all time or even for the current time. They evaluate each unit, each loaf of bread, each carat of diamonds, each glass of water, or gallon, or whatever. And this solves the value paradox, because there's a lot more bread and water around than there are diamonds. And so the relative scarcity of diamonds is greater. Each unit. In other words, lower the margin utility. Margin concentrates or focuses on each unit, and utility means value or placed on a unit. So this means, as I say, the greater the supply of a good, the lower the value of each unit. We don't know the exact slope of this. Matter of fact, you can't even talk about the slope since this value is an ordinal concept. Utility is an ordinal concept. But we do know that it's lower as you get more units of a good. Okay, taking that and also taking the fact that every individual in the market has different value scales and different valuations that he or she places on different commodities, you wind up with a falling demand curve. In other words, that the price of any good or service on the y-axis, quantity on the x-axis, at any given price, at a higher price, people will buy less of it, a lower price will buy more of it. You get something like that. We don't know that it's linear, the demand curve, we just know that it's falling. In that sense, it's a little bit like a utility curve there. For convenience, we make it a straight line, but all we know is it's gonna be, people will buy more of it at a lower price and less of it at a higher price. That's the key. And by knowing that, you already know more than most of the people in the United States, because most people think that the demand curve is, if they think of it at all, is vertical. And regardless of what the price is, people will buy the same amount. You know, they in their daily lives, of course, don't act that way. So we have a falling demand curve, and the major property of the demand curve is elasticity. This is an analogy from physics or physical sciences, where a spring is more elastic. If you place a certain amount of weight on a spring, it's more elastic the more distance it moves by putting a weight on it. Less elastic, less distance it moves. Similarly, the elasticity is how much, if a price falls, the price of any good falls, how much will quantity increase? If it only increases a little bit, the demand curve is considered inelastic. If it increases a lot, it's considered elastic. So in a sense, the flatter, given the point, like here, the flatter the curve, the more elastic it is, and the steeper, the less elastic. The demand curve cannot be horizontal, because it's falling. It's at any given price, and it can't be vertical for the same reason. But somewhere, any demand curve will be within this structure. You can define elasticity in various ways. The textbook definition is all right for its own purposes, where the percentage elasticity is the percentage change in quantity divided by the percentage change in price. That's one way to do it. The trouble with that is There's nothing wrong with it mathematically. Just the trouble is it's irrelevant economically. Nobody really measures this thing because nobody knows what it is anyway. And from the economic point of view, from the point of view of the businessman, the firm, or the industry, what's really important is the direction. What happens to total revenue? That's what it's really concerned with. If you cut price, will total revenue go up or go down? It could work either way. Since total revenue is equal to price times quantity, and since as the price falls, these two things are going in opposite directions, right? In other words, as the price goes down, quantity goes up. And what the impact on total revenue is purely as part of, depends on the problem, depends on the good and the people buying it and all that sort of stuff. Nobody knows in advance what it is. They can have hunches, but nobody knows with any precision what the elasticity of the demand curve is at any time. So the way I define elasticity is the demand curve is elastic if when price change, when price falls, total revenue goes up. So this total revenue, this area here, which is, of course, price times quantity, is greater than this. So the demand curve is elastic if when price falls, total revenue increases. And the demand curve is inelastic if when price falls, total revenue drops. Okay? So this would be elastic, and this would be inelastic. And okay, it's inelastic if when price falls, total revenue decreases. If the total revenue remains the same, in other words, if it's some online here, then it's called unitarily elastic, a unit elasticity. So this is unit or elasticity equal to 1. If price falls, total revenue remains the same. So in other words, we have a schedule here with so this is price and this is quantity, and this price is $10 a whatever it is, the item or the case or whatever, and quantity sold was 100, total revenue is 1,000. The price goes down to 9, and quantity goes up to 120, this is 1,080, and so that means the demand curve is elastic in that zone, in this region. If, on the other hand, it only goes up to 105, then it's 945, right? In that case, total revenue is inelastic. If it just, the percentage change is exactly the same, then it winds up with 1,000, and then it's the total revenue is unitarily elastic, or unit elasticity. Neither elastic nor inelastic. We saw that the demand curves as they were drawn by economics textbooks, in economics textbooks before 1943 approximately, were all like this. They were rectangular hyperbole, which means that the total revenue was always constant, never changed. And the way this got out of the textbook, it takes a lot to get something out of a textbook. Once it's enshrined in the textbook, it takes almost dynamite to get it out. And with Professor Stiegler, a later Nobel Prize winner in economics, said, well, why do they say this? There's no evidence for this nonsense. There's no evidence that the total revenue remains the same. In fact, it probably changes. Why don't we make it a straight line? Ever since then, the demand curves have been straight line. There's no evidence for that either, but at least it doesn't assume constant total revenue. At least you can see that there are changes that go up and down. So this is the most important property of the demand curve, it's elasticity, and that depends whether total revenue goes up or down when the price changes. Of course, the exact opposite occurs when you go up when the price increases. In other words, in economics and microeconomics, you can always change the signs so it's symmetrical. So this is, if the price goes up, elasticity, if the price increases, total revenue falls. Exact opposite happens. You go up in other words, you go up from here. Price goes up from here to here. If the total revenue drops, it's an elastic curve. If the total revenue goes up, it's an inelastic curve. So again, you just reverse this. So if price increases, the total revenue increases, then it's an inelastic demand curve. And similarly, of course, if the price increases and total revenue remains the same, you still have your unit elastic range. On any given demand curve, the elasticity changes in the course of the curve. Just because it's flat or steep doesn't necessarily mean it's elastic or inelastic. If you go down here, it might change. If you go up here, particularly, You might have a steep-looking curve, but eventually, if you keep raising the price, it'll become elastic. In other words, it'll become, total revenue will start falling. As you increase the price of Wonder Bread of $20 a loaf, whatever it is, the total revenue suckers will spend on it will fall considerably. So you can't just look, the only time you can look at the flatness or steepness and say that's elastic or inelastic is when you have the same point. You're referring to the same point. Okay, so that's the that's the elasticity of demand property of that, and then we went to then we brought in the supply line. We now have elasticity of demand. Oh, one thing about elasticity of demand again is that, you know, we don't know what the elasticity is. We do know the more range of choice, other things being equal, the greater the range of choice in the consumer or the buyer has, the more elastic the demand curve will tend to be. So that, in other words, if the the price of Wonder Bread goes up from $1 a loaf to $1.50, and all the other bread prices remain the same, there's going to be a tremendous falling off in purchase. On the other hand, if all the bread prices go up, there'll be a falling off and not nearly as great because there won't be that range of choice. Consumers wouldn't be able to shift from Wonder Bread to Tasty Bread or Pepperidge Farm, all going up. They have to shift the rolls or, you know, whatever. So similarly here, if Wonder Bread is the only firm that cuts its price, you have a big increase in quantity purchased. If all the breads cut their prices, you'd have a small increase, not nearly as much. So the other thing we can say is the demand curve for the firm, the individual firm, is always greater than the demand curve for the industry. Could be a little bit greater, could be a lot greater. We don't know. But we do know it'll be more elastic, demand curve for the firm, unless, of course, the industry has only one firm in it. It becomes the same thing. So, alright, then we move from that to the determination of price. Most important single item, single part of a course. How are prices in the market determined? And two things, in the market, of course, you have exchange of two commodities and two people. And, every exchange is that sort of exchange. I buy a sandwich for whatever it is, a buck and a half or something. I'm exchanging a buck and a half for a sandwich. So this is price again on the y-axis, quantity x-axis. You have a demand curve for any given product, a falling demand curve, and you have at any given time, you have a vertical supply line. In other words, you have a certain number of goods which are out there on the market ready to be sold today. Heads of lettuce, stereo sets, gears, whatever happens to be, or nails. There's a certain amount ready to be sold and a certain demand curve. And then what we maintain is that the day-to-day price on the market will be the intersection point between the demand curve and the supply line. And this will be the equilibrium price, any good or service. If the good or service differs from that, differs from the equilibrium, there are forces in the market which immediately bring it back to that particular intersection point. That's why it's called equilibrium, because equilibrium physics is if something tends to rest at a certain point, if it's displaced from that point, it goes right back to it. And similarly, market forces bring it right back to the equilibrium point. Market forces, in this case, being two things. One is a free price system. In other words, the price system is free to move. And two, desire of businessmen to make profits and avoid losses. That's all you need. Of course, all businessmen have that desire. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in business very long. If they don't desire to avoid losses, for example, they'll lose a lot of money and be out of business. So then we saw that if the price, for example, is higher than the equilibrium point, then there'll be a certain amount ready to be sold, only much less of it sellable to consumers. This will be an unsold surplus, and which will pile up on the shelf, something which all businessmen hate, like the very Dickens, like blazes, the stuff they thought was going to sell and still it's piling up unsold. And then they find as they lower the price of it, lo and behold, more will be sold, so finally as they keep lowering it, surplus is over. So the way the market eliminates unsold surplus is by cutting the price, and as the price falls, you go back to the equilibrium point. Conversely, if the price is below the equilibrium point, there will then be a certain amount ready to be sold, but buyers or consumers will want to buy more than that. At that lower price, they want to buy this much. And this is a shortage. In other words, here you have an excess demand. Demand is greater than supply at that price. Shortage means the thing, stuff disappears from the shelves and break rapidly. And then businessmen say, hey, this means I can raise the price without worrying about cutting sales. And as they raise the price, the shortage becomes more and more over. So finally, you're back to the equilibrium point. No shortage and no surplus. So below the the equilibrium price, demand is greater than supply, excess demand. Above it, supply is greater than demand, in other words, excess supply or unsold surplus. Only at this price is the demand and supply equal. In other words, it's called clearing the market, where supply and demand are exactly equal. As much is sold as the people want to sell. In other words, businessmen produce a certain amount, they want to sell it, and this is exactly the amount that the consumer is willing to buy. So this is the price which will be set determined on the market. This is, in other words, one of the important things this shows is that even though people who don't understand economics think that the market is chaotic, the prices are chaotic, nobody knows why prices are set the way they are, it's all unplanned, there's no government planning board which says, okay, you and you produce this much and sell at that price. Instead of that, it works much better than a government planning thing because it works, it smoothly integrates or harmonizes the amount people want to pay for a product with the amount that people will produce. Equates supply and demand. So every step of the way, either in consumer goods or producer's goods or raw materials or like mining coal, whatever it is, there's never any shortage or any surplus. There's always an equation of demand and supply. even though the individuals on the market may not realize this, don't talk about equating supply and demand. That's the way it works in practice. that's why Adam Smith said the market works as if there's an invisible hand harmonizing everything. Doesn't mean there isn't an invisible hand, it just means that's the way it works. Okay, if the price tends to be set at this particular point, what can change it then? If there's an equilibrium price, why do prices change all the time? And the answer there is, of course, that either supply changes or demand curve changes. Those are the only two things that can change prices. We'll see later on. A cost, the change, an increase in cost cannot increase price. It only does it through cutting supply because these are the only two factors that go into a price determining price. So, if the supply changes, let's say if there's a coffee frost, right now there's a coffee blight, a drought in Brazil. Usually there's a frost every few years. This time there's a big drought. The coffee prices will go up imminently. So in other words, you then have a big drop in supply. Supply curve shifts to the left. It means that the old equilibrium price is now a shortage. Demand is now greater than supply. Prices therefore go up. You wind up with a new equilibrium price, a higher price, which clears the market. So a decrease in supply, a decrease in the supply of X leads to an increase in the price of X. This shows how prices perform a rationing function. Prices perform two important functions. One is a rationing function, rationing the scarcity. If the scarcity is greater, price goes up. If the scarcity is less, the price is cheaper, down to the point where if goods are super abundant, like air, then the price is free. You don't have to worry about it because it's always there. So the greater that you have a question? No. The greater the relative scarcity, the greater the price. Conversely, if the coffee crop is finally adjusted or whatever, comes back in a normal situation, then you have an increase in the supply. At the old equilibrium price, you don't have a surplus. In order to induce people to buy more of coffee, you have to lower the price. As the price is lowered, you eliminate the surplus, you wind up with a new equilibrium price where the supply is greater and the price is lower. In other words, scarcity is less now, and therefore the rationing thing becomes less intense. An increase in the supply leads to a drop in price. now, over time, most goods in a free market economy, goods tend to increase as you have increased capital investment and better technology. Most goods, supply tends to increase, and so prices tend to fall. In other words, the general trend is of falling prices. And you can see that dramatically in areas where you have tremendous increase in productivity. In the last few years, computers, calculators, TV sets, and things like that, where prices are falling even though you have general inflation, in the teeth of general inflation, which means the real prices, in other words, prices in terms of the price level as a whole, are falling even more than you might think. if you consider per unit quality, which is the way you really have to think of prices, because a good is homogeneous. Remember, if we define a good as N homogeneous units, supply of a good, which means that N homogeneous units. So in order to be really homogeneous, you have to have the same quality. Usually in the market economy, the quality improves all the time. As a matter of fact, except for government, in the private capitalist sector, quality of goods are always going up, and the quality of TV sets are much better than it used to be. Quality of computers and all that sort of stuff. And the price fall is much greater than you might think, because it's a tremendous fall per unit, price fall per unit quality. And then only in government sector, I think the quality always going down, like the post office. Beloved post office used to deliver mail twice a day. It's now once a day, if that. Okay. So as the, not only are prices going up, not only the price of stamps go up, but the quality goes down in government. Okay, so that's the supply side of the situation. If you ask the question, if prices are always going, tending to go down, how come prices are always going up in general? The answer is the macro course. That's, you learn that next term or whatever. It's because government keeps pouring more money into the system. In other words, government is like a vast counterfeiter. In fact, it is a vast counterfeiter. It just prints money all the time and creates more money. As it creates more money, of course, prices tend to go up. As greater demand, you know, as demand curves go up, everybody's got more money in their pockets than they had before, which tends to offset the fall in prices due to increased productivity. Okay, that's the, so that's the supply side. We now get to demand. What can increase the demand curve, change the demand curve? And when we talk about demand increasing or decreasing, we mean the entire curve shifting up or down. And again, I'm going to repeat this again for the nth time. Should not confuse going down or up at the given demand curve with a change in the whole curve. When the supply increases, the price goes down, the quantity demanded goes up. In other words, the quantity sold, produced and sold goes up. The quantity demanded goes up, but the entire demand curve does not go up. It doesn't change. The reason it doesn't change is the demand curve is defined as the locus of what happens when prices change. In other words, you have a certain amount, at any given price, how much will be purchased. So if the price falls, unless you say the demand curve is going to change, which we know there's no reason why it should, as the price falls, the quantity demanded goes up, but the demand curve as a whole, demand as a whole remains constant. The demand curve remains constant. You're going down the given demand curve. So the only thing which cannot increase the demand curve is a change in price. The only thing which can't cut the demand curve is a change in price. Because the demand curve is defined as response to prices. Okay. So that in other words, when the demand curve goes up, why should the demand curve go up? Well, it can go up for many reasons. Either because the government prints more money. Everybody's got more money in their pocket. Okay. One reason to go up. The demand curve going up means, technically, at any given price, more will be purchased than there was before. So whatever the price is, there's an increase in purchases. So if everybody's got more money, if the government prints a lot of money and distributes it around, by spending, by lending it out, and ripples through the system, then the demand curve will shift upward. Or if there's a big tax cut, let's say, we'll have more money in our pockets, the demand curve will shift upward. That's one reason for general curves to shift upward. For individual items, it's due to changes in taste, changes in fashion, changes in values. There's all sorts of value change. It can be important or they could be frivolous. Economists don't worry about that. That's up to moralists and whatever, social psychologists, whatever it is. All we register is the fact that the demand curves go up or down. Values change. they could be, because, for example, it used to be the big game around here, outdoor game was hula hoops. Big fan for hula hoops 1 year. And everybody bought hula hoops. Big increase in demand curve for hula hoops. And then hula hoops drop out and frisbees come in. Big frisbee boom, which I think is probably still going on, frisbees. I don't know. I'm not really up on all this. But at any rate, and then, of course, a couple of years ago came the famous Cabbage Patch doll caper, where, I mean, they've been making dolls for hundreds of years, and nobody got excited one way. All of a sudden, Cabbage Patch doll, that was it. Okay, so, and people, one guy flew to London to buy it, because in London they hadn't had this big Cabbage Patch doll boom. So he had his way paid for. I think his wife was a travel agent or something like that, or a stewardess. So, but still in all, it was obviously very expensive to schlep to London and buy a doll for Christmas. So it was a big, but it's still going on. And then the question for the Cabbage Patch doll people is, will this continue? Is it a flash in the pan? Well, they have to figure it out. They have to play their hunches, their insight on the market, whatever it is. again, as I mentioned, there's been a big shift in values over the last 40 years or so, out of pork and into beef, dark beer into light beer, out of red wine into white wine, out of bourbon into vodka, and so forth and so on. So they're shifts up and down. In other words, in some cases, there's a drop and decrease in the demand curve. Other cases, there's an increase. Okay, so when the demand curve increases, there's a rise in price. Because, in other words, at the old price, it means the old price is now a shortage. prices are bid up until we get to the higher price. When the demand curve falls, there's a drop in, means that the old price is now a surplus. People don't want to buy it anymore. And so there's a price fall to induce people to buy the available supply, and the price goes down. Then we get into the fact that as the demand changes, if the demand is considered, fairly permanent, then there will be a change in supply. Supply in the long run in response to demand. So that in other words, if there's an increase in the demand curve for vodka, then people realize that the vodka makers say, okay, we're going to get out of bourbon. Hell with bourbon. We're going to get into more and more vodka. And as they do that, depending on the technology, how long this takes, it all depends on the individual item, they'll start increasing the supply of vodka. And so over the years, you get something like this. You get a price which is somewhere in between, usually, between the old and the suddenly increased price. So you wind up then with a higher price, perhaps, and a greater output. In the case of fall of the demand curve, you wind up, you have a big drop in the demand for bourbon, and producers get out of bourbon, and we're going to produce less of that. And then over the years, you don't have a lower production and a higher price from the original, so somewhere in between again. So in this way, consumers, over the long run, because we didn't see, first we talk about a given supply line. Well, then we start talking about what determines the supply line. It's not God-given. It was due to previous decisions by producers, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, whatever, depending on the good. In the case of liquor or wine, particularly, it takes many years, of course, for wine to ripen and stuff like that. But anyway, over the long run, then you get in a situation where if an increased demand will then induce a greater supply of the product, a lower demand will cause a lower supply of the product. So that way, supply, production, response to consumer demand. And a greater demand will cause greater output and vice versa. Except, of course, in goods which are output are fixed forever, like Rembrandt paintings. Until you get a perfect forgery, which is, these days, the technology is almost impossible because they can date stuff, you know, things like that. Supply of Rembrandt is dead gone with Rembrandt, so it's absolutely fixed. Certainly can't be increased. Once in a while you can lose a painting or somebody can destroy it, but you cannot increase. So, anyway, so that way, supply on the market, production response to consumer demand. First of all, what people expect consumer demand will be, and then if the producers are right, if demand is increased, then they'll make profits. This will spur them to make even more of them. If they're wrong, and it turns out that, say, the increased demand for vodka was only temporary, then they'll lose a lot of money and they'll cut back. So in other words, profits and losses are a signal to producers of whether they're on the right track or not. They make higher profits, they'll increase demand, they'll increase the production. They make lower profits or losses, then they'll cut back. And so the profits are like a signal whether they're on the right track at serving consumers or not. And later, after the midterm, we'll get into theory of the firm, part three, and we'll get to start talking about costs and production and so on, how production is determined and how profits are determined, things like that. Okay, so then that sort of covered any given good. Then we went into relationships between goods. There's the two major ones are substitutability, co-substitutes, right? Where goods are substitutes for each other in the same, fulfilling the same market. Coffee and tea, cocoa and tea, and that sort of thing. Metals, aluminum and steel. All these things can fill more or less the same. They're not perfect substitutes, but they're fairly close. And so what happens, for example, when the supply curve of coffee went down and coffee became more scarce and more expensive, people shifted more and more to tea and cocoa. So you then have as a result of this, there's an increase in demand curve for tea, let's say. And the price of tea tended to go up. And cocoa the same way. So we can then say that the decrease in the supply of X brings about an increase in the price. This increase in the price will in turn bring about an increase in demand for Y, the substitute, which in turn will raise the price of Y. et cetera, you can just change the sign and get the same, you know, an increase in supply of X will cause a drop in the price of X, cause a drop in the demand for Y, a drop in the price. You know, as coffee gets cheaper, let's say, people will shift out of tea into coffee, and the demand curve for tea will go down, the price of tea will fall. And eventually, of course, the output in the long run. Then there's complements. In a complement, the two goods go together. Instead of being substitutes, sort of battling each other, a complement, they go together. They're either demanded together or produced together. In the case of joint demand, in cases like ham and eggs or steak and steak sauce or bread and butter, things like that, which are demanded together, or baseball caps, baseball gloves, you know, all the rest of it, or factors that go in labor and capital and land go into a certain production. If the demand for champagne goes up, you have an increase in the demand for champagne labor, an increase in the demand for champagne machinery and champagne land. All these things will increase, the prices will go up, wage rates will go up in champagne country and so forth and so on. So these are joint demand. And one interesting thing there is what happens when the supply changes one of these factors. In other words, they say bread and butter, the sandwiches, right? The bread and butter are going to sandwiches. If the price of butter gets cheaper, spectacularly cheaper because of an increase in productivity or fertilizer or whatever, then the price will fall, increase in supply of X, and this will make sandwiches cheaper, and the result of that will be an increase in demand for bread. And with more sandwiches will be purchased. But bread hasn't gotten cheaper. I mean, bread is the same supply as before, so the price of bread will go up. And so this causes an increase in demand for Y and an increase in the price of Y. And you have, with joint, this is joint demand, this is what happens. complements. And of course, again, the sign is reversed. If the supply goes down for butter, let's say there's a big cow shortage or something like that, the price goes up, which means the demand for sandwiches goes down, which means the demand for bread goes down, the price of bread goes down. So in both cases, the price is going in opposite directions here, between the two factors. When the supply is the source of the change, when demand is the source of change, it's easy to see what happens. All the demand curves go up or go down, and that's it. In the case of supply, however, it gets a little trickier. And the other jointness, the other complement was joint supply, where two goods are simply produced together. They're found together in nature. Beef and hides is a famous example. Beef cattle are killed for meat. And also, of course, there's their skin, which is used for leather, hides or leather. And same way with copper and silver, which are found together, and so forth and so on. Here what happens is that you have a response. In other words, when there's an increase in demand for beef over time, the demand curve goes up, supply then goes up in the long run, and yet then, as a result of that, an increase in the supply of hides or leather, which causes a drop in the price. So, in other words, demand for X goes up, increase in demand for beef, let's say, and this increases the price, which in turn increases the supply of X in the long run. And this, in turn, increases the supply of Y, which lowers the price of Y. That's the way they schematize that. And, of course, again, you reverse the signs, and the exact opposite happens in every case. This finishes the relationship between goods. And then we talk about what happens when the government interferes in this process. A whole bunch of case studies about that. This can be summed up as either maximum price control or minimum price control. We always talk about cartels a little bit, but that's not going to be on the... That'll be next after the midterm. Going more into that. In maximum price control, which is more common, the government orders that you can't sell a good above a certain price, which is below the market equilibrium price. Free market equilibrium price. This is maximum price control, which tries to lower the price below the equilibrium by force. In other words, putting a floor on it, a ceiling on it, excuse me. Preventing it from going up. One of the situations we saw this caused all sorts of problems. First place, it causes a shortage. It means the shortage cannot be eliminated in the market. You have a permanent shortage, which gets worse over time as the supply goes down, because of unprofitability of the whole product. And then you have black markets, which are very high prices. They're very scarce. They can't advertise. They have to pay off the cops and all that. You have like a small black market around the edges, and a decline in them rationing through lining up, so being on a waiting list or standing in line, because this has to be rationed some way. If the price system can't ration, it's got to be done through coercion, through ration tickets or standing in line, through favoritism, through the producer taking over racial and religious discrimination, because the producer that can, because the producer's in the South, he doesn't worry about customers. There are plenty of too many customers. Then he can ration customers. He says, okay, I like this guy, and this guy's my brother-in-law. This guy's in the same race as I am, and how about everybody else? So this is, these are all, and also the decline in quality. A hidden price increase is a quality of decline, which cannot be policed. It's almost impossible, except for certain visible things. But police the decline in quality, figure out, is there really less almonds now than used to be in the chocolate almond crunch ice cream. So, and of course it doesn't really cure inflation. Usually maximum price growth is supposed to cure inflation. It doesn't do that at all. It simply makes things worse. Inflation is caused by an increase in demand curves due to an increase in money supply, which keeps bubbling along merrily anyway. And minimum price control, the government keeps the price above the equilibrium point, free market equilibrium, and this perpetuates the surplus. In other words, instead of the surplus being eliminated quickly through the price system, but now if this is a minimum price, called a price floor, perpetuates unsold surplus. In many cases, the surplus gets worse over time because the producers will produce more of it. Hey, the price is pretty good here. And calls forth an even greater surplus, which the government has to handle in some way. The two big examples of this are the farm price support program, which is a total mess and getting worse as the surpluses keep piling up. And minimum wage laws, which create unemployment among the lowest paid workers. Examples of maximum price control are Legion. There are not only things like meat control, World War II, and all sorts of other things. There's also the water shortage caused by water price control, the traffic congestion caused by price of traffic, so to speak, being virtually zero, price of driving and whatever. And all sorts of other stuff, rent control, which causes a housing apartment shortage and causes all sorts of ways to try to evade the regulations. All these things are examples of price control in action. That really, I guess, sums up the course. I haven't left you much time for questions. Any questions on any part of the course? Any of the stuff? No, you all know it perfectly. Magnificent. Okay, good luck. Well, I just got back from Europe, so I have not been able to, I haven't seen the exams yet. I will mark them by Thursday and give them back. Went to Europe. Well, I went to Poland, the conference in Poland, and London, and toured around the continent a bit. But basically, it was a Polish conference. And no, I mean, our school? Good heavens, no. Just be kidding. No, it was organized, financed from London, organized from London. And the Polish scholars there were all against the government. It was heroic. It was very openly. Even though it was probably an apparatchik spy and attendance, they didn't care. No, they're very outspoken. There are no Polish intellectuals in favor of the government now. So it's sort of like a peculiar kind of equilibrium, as they said, the government realizes that and doesn't do anything about it. So it's a very odd situation. apparently this is the only place in Eastern Europe where they could have had a conference of this sort. Even in Hungary, which is much freer economically, is not as intellectually free. So that was very interesting. So anyway, it was heartwarming to see. I mean, the whole country is sort of falling apart, but at least they're intellectually in good shape. Yeah, no, you can't get any Wonder Bread. You can't get any American or English papers either, so it's kind of a news blackout. any rate, to return to our the muttons here. Okay, we're into the theory of the firm, and the objective of each firm is to maximize their profits, or rather to have as high a profit as they can to avoid losses. Profits are equal to total revenue minus total cost. In other words, over a year period, let's say, take any time period, the money you take in minus the money you pay out. And this, of course, gets very complicated in practice, but in theory, it's pretty simple. Understand, if you take in $1.5 million and you pay out $1.0 million, then you have a profit of $500,000. Okay? if you unfortunately pay out $1 million and take in only 0.5, then you have losses of $500,000. So everybody's trying to, every business firm, business entity, tries to maximize their profit, increase their profits, and avoid losses. They can't always do that. Losses often pop up, largely because the costs are paid out immediately before the money is taken in. In other words, you have to build your plant, whatever it is. You have to hire your workers, buy raw material, get all the stuff together, and then try to sell the product, and then try to sell the product at a profit. So the payout comes now, and the income comes later, and there's often, of course, a big slip here. There's consumers don't always do what the, or buyers don't always do what the investors think they're going to do. So they often make losses, and they try, of course, very hard not to. So this is the, and this goal of trying to maximize profits and avoid losses drives the whole economic free market system and equilibrates everything, equilibrates supply and demand, as we saw in the first part of the course, at each step of the way, because everybody's trying to increase profits and avoid losses. It's a very simple but effective motivation on the part of a businessman, especially in the fact that the businessman has already paid out the money and doesn't want to lose it. So it's a very powerful incentive. there's been questions, not so much among economists, some economists, a small minority, mostly among intellectuals, sociologists, people of that ilk, writers, literary types, claiming that, well, it's true in the 19th century the business firms wanted to maximize profits, but now it's not true anymore. Now the managers have taken over. And managers don't care about profits, so they just want to have a minimal amount. They want to increase the size of their operations, they want a quiet life, or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. Most of this is generally a lot of nonsense. As a matter of fact, it works the other way around. As the corporation gets bigger, there's less and less of the sort of mom-and-pop kind of motivation. In other words, if you own a grocery store, you know, with two employees, your wife might persuade you to hire your incompetent brother-in-law. You know he's incompetent, and he's losing money for you, but still, in order to keep peace in the family, you hire him anyway. So there's a lot of that goes on in family businesses. But with a corporation, as the firms get larger and get incorporated, there's much less of that. There's some of that, of course, but much less of it because you have to satisfy stockholders. You haven't got sort of a personal operation anymore. So the drive for maximizing money profits is even stronger in corporations than it is with personal firms. There's also a drive to keep peace, and private utility takes over, psychic utility, in some cases more important than money profit. Well, obviously you have to have a certain, you can't make losses because then you go out of business. So the drive for maximizing money profit is even stronger with corporations than it is with personal mom-and-pop firms, so to speak. The idea that the managers have taken over, which came out with a famous book by Burley and Means, Two New Dealers, in 1930, I think it was called The Modern Corporation and Private Property, a very famous book. Means, I guess, was sort of an economist, although I sort of question it, but Burley was a corporate lawyer. Their thesis was that in modern corporate firms, the managers have taken over. Stockholders are no longer important. They don't count. The managers sort of seize power. And what they want is essentially increasing the size of the company, or they don't care much about profits, status, whatever the motivations are. This, I think, is refutable fairly easily. It's true the managers often don't care that much about profits. On the other hand, if they don't make profits, if their profit, if their earning ratio doesn't look too hot, the stockholders, first of all, get sore. And the getting sore doesn't necessarily mean they'll kick them out. It is difficult to kick out managers. There's like a little political machine. The stockholders have to get together and organize. There's a lot of them. There's maybe 2 million stockholders in a big corporation. They don't have to organize. The interesting thing about a corporation is all the stockholders have to do to exert their power is to vote with their pocketbook. In other words, sell the stock. So if you own 10 shares or 100 shares of General Motors stock, and you think General Motors is not doing very well, its profits are low, etc., you just sell the stock and buy something else. The act of selling the stock drives down the price of the stock and makes the managers very upset because they don't like the fact that the value of their stock is going down. Also, so selling the stock is a sort of a key thing here. So long before the stockholders start organizing to kick out the managers and get somebody else in, they sell the stock and the value of the shares goes down. The managers also own shares. After all, managers get paid partly in shares of a corporation, especially with income tax the way it is. They don't have to pay money on the shares of stock. So a top president of a corporation might make $200,000 in salary and $500,000 in shares of stock of a company. So he himself is a stockholder and is worried about, he doesn't like to see the value of the stock going down. So it works very in a very quick, smooth fashion. You don't have to have the big dramatic vote. In contrast to that, of course, is government operation. We should always contrast and compare government with private enterprise. And a government firm, government agency, say the post office, right, the beloved postal service, or the transportation authority, we can't sell our shares in it. We're supposed to be owners. We, the people, are alleged owners of a public corporation. We're taxpayers and they're citizens, therefore owners. We can't sell our share if we don't like Metropolitan Transit Authority. We don't like the way the rotten subway system is run. We can't sell our shares in this because we ain't got no shares. We can't sell our shares in the rotten post office either. If we could do that, it'd be a very different situation. We'd keep the managers on their toes. But the managers get paid from the taxpayer. They don't care. There's no shareholders to worry about. So shareholders exert an enormous amount of power even without voting. Voting is just a small part of it. By selling their shares, by the value of the shares going down, they register the signal to the manager, you better shape up, fella, because you're going to lose out. So, selling shares of stock is very important. Stock market every day evaluates and reevaluates corporations without fear or favor. They don't care about the fact that the guy's been beloved and he's been a member of the Union League Club, has been entrenched for 30 years. They don't care about that. If the profit prospects are bad, they start selling their share and the stock value goes down. Also, of course, in addition to selling the stock, which is the key thing, keeping managers honest, is so-called takeover bids, as you see very dramatically. If the share of stock gets low, in other words, if it's basically a sound corporation but being badly managed, and the value of the share goes way down, this becomes a tempting for takeover bids for other capitalists to say, look, to write letters to the shareholders and say, look, get us in there. We'll take this company. We'll make a big profit out of it. And we prove our judgment and our capacity for making profits by giving you a much bigger deal and you're getting better deal than you're getting now. Let's say if the value of a share of a corporation is, say, $70 a share, we'll pay you $100 a share if you get us in, if you sell us enough shares so we can take over. So this is a powerful incentive. It's also a powerful incentive for the existing managers to shape up and not let the corporation run down and not make profits. Otherwise, somebody will come in with a takeover bid. Interestingly enough, liberals and the liberal media, the establishment, so to speak, is always in favor of the managers. If you notice this, next time you notice about a takeover bid, they always hate the takeover bidder. Takeover bidder is a corporate raider. He's a pirate. He comes from Texas, which sort of automatically makes him evil. He's displacing these beloved managers who've been here for 30 years. Well, that's the whole point of capitalism and the market economy. You're being displaced if you do a lousy job. And so this is what competition is all about. And it's interesting that liberals who tend to be, who propounded the idea that the terrible thing managers have taken over from stockholders, when it gets down to the bone and the stockholders revolt, they're always in favor of the managers against the stockholders. It's an interesting little item here. Any change in the status quo they consider somehow disrupting and bad in some sense. Of course, the managers are there telling the existing manager, the president of whatever corporation is being under a quote, attack, unquote, from a takeover bid, is giving interviews to the New York Times or the Post or whatever it is, and CBS, and saying, look, it's a terrible thing. These guys are from Texas and they're evil. Guys from Texas aren't here and established, and therefore they don't have the access to the media that the local people do. So so there's always a poison atmosphere against the newcomers. Reinforced often by court decisions. Of course, the lawyers are in there all the time. Every one of these guys has fleets of corporate lawyers battling in the courts for years to try to stop takeover bids, to try to facilitate them. But anyway, the takeover bid has been a powerful weapon in keeping the managers on their toes and kicking them out if they don't do a lousy job. So you don't have to wait for the stockholders themselves to organize and get together. The takeover bidder, so T-Bone Pickens or whoever it is, comes in and says, okay, I'm going to buy Carl Icahn, whatever these guys are. They come in and say, okay, we're going to buy this corporation. We think it's doing a lousy job. We can do a lot better. We'll pay the shareholders $30 on the share, which is a powerful incentive. So anyway, through these methods, through takeover bids, especially through selling stock, stockholders are effectively the directors or runners, owners of a corporation, not the managers. Although the managers get the publicity, of course, on a day-to-day basis. Of course, if I own one share of General Motors, I'm not going to have much of a say in it, obviously. I'm not saying each individual stockholder, except through selling stock as a share, has the power. But if you have, let's say, 10% of the stock, or a group of people have 10 or 15%, you can basically run it. And, of course, if the manager does a lousy job, you might not want to run it anymore. You might want to sell it to somebody else who comes over to take over a bit. So in this way, stock market works in such a way as to make the market economy as efficient as possible, as profitable and as efficient and serving the consumers as humanly possible, and making the managers shape up. That's true. The managers do try to finagle from time to time. For example, when you're estimating your profits during inflation, let's say you have a $1 million machine and you spent $1 million on it, say 1980, and let's say it's a 10-year machine. So it'll 1990 is going to have to be replaced. Orthodox accounting methods. This is, I think, I've referred to this in the past here. There's a constant war between accountants and economists. It's been going on for about 40 years since the modern age of inflation has gotten underway. If you buy a machine for $1 million, you're supposed to evaluate it on the books at $1 million. That's called historical cost accounting. And then in other words, this is what you actually pay for. You paid $1 million. And then 10 years later, if you have to replace it, you depreciate, say, $100,000 a year, so you have a fund of $1 million to buy another one. So this is all very well if there's no inflation. Okay, but if you have a chronic inflation, as we've had now since World War II, this is not going to work. This distorts the actual picture of a corporate firm. Because, let's say prices have doubled in these 10 years, which is not unusual. Prices, in fact, have gone up eightfold since 1940, threefold since, tripled since 1967, okay, tripled in the last 20 years. So if they double in these 10 years, and you take your $1 million, 1990 to replace the machine, you find you can only buy half of it. You need another million to replace it. So that the replacement cost, which is really the important thing, who cares about the historical cost? It's interesting for historians. But if it now costs $2 million because of inflation, it means you're wiping out your capital. In other words, you think you may have big profits, but you really haven't. In other words, let's say if you think your profit is $5 million this year, but it's only because you have to replace a couple of machines and you're reckoning it as $1 million, but it really costs $2 million. You really made very, very little profits. In other words, this is profit. You overinflate. You inflate how much your profit you make because you don't take into account the increase in capital cost, increase in cost of replacement of machinery. So ever since inflation started after World War II, the economists have been telling accountants, look, this is great if you don't have inflation, but it's distorting the whole picture. Accountants are finally beginning to come around after about 40 years to realizing they've got to do something. That's true, it gets sloppy, you see. If you base it as $1 million, if you paid $1 million for it, you have a check in 1980 saying, okay, I paid $1 million for this. This is objective. That's precise. If you're trying to estimate how much inflation is, it's not objective. It's not precise, as we see in macro courses. It's very imprecise, but still, you have to do something, because otherwise you're going to be wiped out. Your capital investments are going to be wiped out. So as a result, what happens is, over the years, there's been a connivance between, of course, accountants who've been large in the 19th century accounting methods, pre-inflationary accounting methods, the government, the IRS, which always wants to have tax more. If you think that higher profits, it means the government can tax it away. And managers who like to fool their stockholders into thinking that profits are high. Managers don't like to tell their stockholders, look, it looks like the high profits has really been eaten away by inflation. There's been sort of a conspiracy for many years of accountants, top managers in the government, each one trying to bolster the old accounting cost system. But as I say, after about 30 or 40 years, finally it's begun to sunk in. It's more or less shifting now toward a more rational accounting system. But anyway, this is one of the pitfalls here. And it's some ways in which which at least in the short run, top managers try to fool the stockholders. It doesn't work forever. It's at least sort of a short run advantage. Of course, Burley and Means didn't talk about that. the places again where the managers really take over is, of course, the government. There's almost no check at all. You can't sell your share in the post office, and therefore the taxpayer gets sucked in, doesn't know what's going on. And the government bureaucrats can then go right, high, wide, and handsome. There's also another, there's a famous attack on the idea of maximizing profits, the so-called questionnaire method. These are sociologists who go around a businessman, they go to, say, the president of the chairman of the board, saying, is it your goal, sir, to maximize profits? Of course they're going to say no. I mean, you know, it sounds terrible. No, my goal is not to maximize profits. My goal is to help the world and the country and God and all that sort of stuff. And, and we'd like to stay in business to be able to do that. Okay? So this is not the way you go. And then they conclude from this, the sociologists, that therefore business is not in favor of maximizing their profits. This is not the sort of question you ask. Paul Samuelson, I'm not a great friend of Paul Samuelson, but in his textbook on economics, he did an effective two-paragraph smash of this. What he said was, look, what you ask a businessman is this. You don't ask him, are you in favor of maximizing your profit? You say, looking back on your decisions that you made last year, you know, pick all your business decisions, is there any one decision where you deliberately avoided making profits, where you said, no, I'll take a cut in profits? A businessman always says, why should I do that? Why should I do a crazy thing like that? Of course not. So in other words, you take the marginal approach. You break it down to the marginal units. You say, in each of these 50 decisions that you made, in each one you tried to increase your profit as much as you could on that, make as much profit as you could, and not try to cut your profit. And then, of course, conceding the fact that your goal is to maximize profits. So it depends on the way you put it. You know, you put it in the sense of looking at each decision, what did you do? And you get a rational answer, of course. That's basically it. You don't get a guff about the public welfare and your country and stuff like that. So at any rate, so the goal of each business firm is to increase your profits as much as you can and to avoid losses. Okay. Total revenue. First of all, I was going to bring in the readings. Read the stuff. Does anybody have the book here? Miller book. The readings, the next set of readings, I think I have it on the syllabus, if anybody sees the syllabus. I think chapter 9. I'll tell you next time. I have it in my briefcase. It's a chapter on thank you. Great. This is part 3, chapters 4, 9, 10, 12, and 14. At this point, up until this point, I've been more or less agreeing with the book, except I don't have a lot of stuff the book has I don't talk about. From now on, it gets to be much more divergent, because Miller is better than most other books on this topic, because the people who write textbooks are mired in the tradition. They have to present a certain apparatus, even though they don't agree with it, and at least they feel they do. So, I'm going to take a much shorter and more common sense view of this whole situation. This is important for you, because you don't have to worry about two-thirds to nine-tenths of the material you're going to read, just because I'm not going to talk about it, and if I don't talk about it, it's not going to be on a test. Okay. You start with the basic diagram here is on the y-axis, instead of price, and y-axis is dollars, which is sort of like price, except now it's just total dollars. X-axis, quantity of goods, as usual, quantity on the x-axis. If you're a business firm, you're making a certain product, whatever it is. If you don't sell anything, you're not going to get anything. You're not going to get any income. Okay, so you start with zip. You start at the point of origin. Sell zero. If I sell zero steel bars, I get zero revenue from it. Okay. A total revenue, as we've seen up until now in the course, of course, is price times quantity. And this, of course, is a demand curve. That's price on the y-axis. And whatever it is, the quantity x-axis, whatever the slope is. So we know that total revenue is the area, okay, and it depends on the elasticity of the demand curve, which can be whatever it is, can be anything, as long as it's falling. Well, if the price falls, here's quantity and price. These are two basic diagrams. The old diagram we're familiar with, price on the y-axis, quantity on the x-axis. And this is the new one, dollars on the y-axis and quantity on the x-axis. Here's a business firm, it's making whatever it is, widgets. If it makes certain amount, it sells at a certain price. Now, this is the point here. If it lowers the price and increases the quantity to here, total revenue will change to whatever it is. If it's elastic, in other words, if the total revenue goes up, as the price falls, if this is fairly flat. Then we depict it on this diagram, quantity increases from here to here, total revenue goes up. Obviously it has to go up from zero anyway, right? And you can't get lower than zero. So total revenue, we start with a rising total revenue curve. This is TR. As quantity increases. And it keeps going up to a certain extent, whatever. It finally gets to the point, let's say, as quantity increases where total revenue falls. Right? Becomes inelastic after a certain zone. When that happens, you have a dip. In other words, it reaches a peak, the total revenue now falls. This part of the curve is the elastic demand curve zone, by definition. In other words, when the quantity increases, price goes up, and total revenue increases, that means it's elastic. When the total revenue declines when quantity goes up and the price falls, this means it's inelastic. This is the inelastic zone. Now the textbooks all have, this is their curve. They have a one peak curve. It doesn't have to be one peak. God does not decree it has to be one peak. It could start going up again. It could be two peaks. Or whatever. Okay, I prefer this kind of a curve because it shows that there's no reason why it has to be one peak except convenience of the guy who draws the diagram. Okay, so in this case, this would be elastic again, and this would be inelastic after this. Okay. So it's an n peak total revenue curve. In this case, it's two. I admit that it's more convenient to have one peak, but it tends to mislead the reader and the student because you tend to think, well, somehow somebody decrees it's only one peak. It doesn't have to be. It can be inelastic and elastic and inelastic again and whatever. Total cost, as Professor Hoppe, I think, mentioned to you in the last lecture. Again, in the diagram, what you have is in the textbook, you have dollars on the y-axis, quantity on the x-axis, quantity of goods. You have a total cost curve. In the first place, the total cost curve, it goes like that. It doesn't have to be like that. God did not decree it has to be like that. It could be almost anything. In other words, it could be higher, it could be lower. If you want to increase cost, if you're paid to increase cost, you'll do it. Very easy. If a businessman loved to have the government tell them, let's say, increase your cost and we will recompense you for it. This is essentially the cost plus defense contract kind of system. Firms love defense contracts because they can get a guaranteed profit at a cost plus rate. In other words, government tells you, look, whatever your costs are, we'll pay you back plus 8% profit or whatever it is. It's not the percentage that counts, it's the fact that the profit is guaranteed. So if the government will reimburse everybody's costs, what the hell? Let her rip. Have beautiful offices. It's very easy to increase costs. The pleasure. It's tough to cut costs. That's very difficult. You start paying high salaries. You hire a lot of engineers. If you notice, for example, that the defense contract advertisements for engineers are much bigger than non-defense firms because their advertising costs are repaid by the government. What the hell? The government pays your advertising costs for engineers. Get full page ads in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. Engineers come to glorious California. Okay. If you're a firm which has to make it in the free market, you can't afford to do that. You have to be more modest. So if you can convince the government that these are reasonable costs, in other words, you need engineers, it's certainly reasonable to have ads, then you can let her rip. Of course, what's reasonable is very elastic. Depends on whether you're the buddy of the guy of the defense department. Usually you are. And so the whole thing is very cozy, and the costs tend to escalate like that. That's why you have the $6,000 coffee machines and that sort of stuff. Because there's no market test saying you're going to lose defense contracts, defense firm will go out of business, or the Pentagon will go out of business if they lose money. Uncle Sap, the taxpayer, that thus pays the bill. Okay, so therefore it goes skyrockets. This cost curve in the textbook is only when the firm is trying desperately to cut costs so as to avoid losses, and was to keep the total cost at a minimum, as low as possible, so that they'll make profits. So this cost curve is the envelope, it's the lower end, the minimum envelope of an array of possible costs. In other words, it's the lowest cost at any given quantity produced. And the reason why business firms will operate the lowest cost is because it's their economic interest to do so, to try and make profits and avoid losses. They will try their damnedest to keep their costs as low as possible for any given output. That's why you have the cost curve. If you didn't have the free market incentive to avoid losses and make profits, the course can be any place. It'll skyrocket. You know, the $5,000 coffee machines and $20 nails and that sort of thing. It can be almost anything. So that's one thing. We have a minimum, it's the minimum envelope of possible costs. The other thing is that the next point of dispute here is my contention is if you don't make any widgets, I'm not a widget manufacturer, I make zero widgets per year, zero steel bar, zero stereo set, therefore my costs are zero. There's no such thing as fixed cost, it's all baloney. In other words, you start again at the point of origin. Zero quantity, zero cost. And it's true that there are different kinds of indivisibilities we'll get into later in costs. You build a plant, you have a fixed cost of operation, even if you don't produce any widgets. But you don't have to have a plant. You can sell the damn plant. You can get out. You can shut it down. You don't have to have fixed costs. There's no such thing as fixed costs. They're all different degrees of variability. So you can toss out all this fixed variable stuff, which unfortunately is at the heart of much microeconomic textbooks. And what you got really is this. You have total costs, which start a total cost curve, the minimum and the lowest envelope of possible costs, any given quantity, and start at the point of origin, total cost zip. And my contention is, which I now have to prove, okay, is the total costs always go up. In other words, that total cost always increase as quantity increases. So this is not self-evident. As a matter of fact, many people think, well, geez, it's not true. Costs of large-scale production? Don't the cost curve go down? Not total cost, however. Average cost goes down, as we'll see. Total costs keep going up. And this can be proven logically. In other words, while total revenue can either go up or down, depending on, because there are two forces at work. Remember, total revenue is prices and it's quantity, each going in different directions. Price goes down, quantity goes up. And it's a tug of war to see what happens to total revenue. It can either go up or down. Total costs are, on the other hand, always going up. Okay, let's prove it by reductio ad absurdum, the easiest way to demonstrate this. In other words, to show that anything else is illogical and absurd. Let's take, this is quantity produced total cost. Let's say, here you have a business firm is producing 100 cases, 100 widgets, 100 steel bars, whatever the unit happens to be. Let's assume that it's minimum total cost. Remember, this is minimum, the lowest envelope. The minimum total cost is, I don't know, $5,000. Okay? Doesn't matter what it is. Now the firm makes another unit and increases its quantity to, say, 101. What I'm saying is it's illogical and absurd to say that the total cost goes down to, say, $4,500. It's impossible. It's logically impossible. For this reason, if your minimum total cost is $5,000 for making 100, and you make 101, you have to produce, to say that the total cost goes down, okay, means you can take the 40, you can, let's put it this way, if you say that, look, I'm saying this is impossible for this reason, I'll demonstrate it this way. If the minimum total cost for producing 101 is 4,500, it means you could produce the 101 for 4,500, you could throw away one, and you're left then with this is 4,500 and not at 5,000. In other words, the initial conditions of the problem are impossible. See what I mean? In other words, it's impossible to say that if you increase the production that you lower the total cost, because then you can take the lower total cost, throw the extra one away, and you're left then with 4,500. You can't, the initial conditions of the problem are then violated. So, and you can't even have it the same, because one more costs something, even if it's a little bit, even for, you know, the material on the one widget will cost a few cents, you know. It can't even be the same then, because you can take that and you can throw that away. So therefore, the total cost always has to go up. In other words, remember, this is the minimum total cost. The minimum can't be 5,000, and this can't be less then, because, as I said, if you can then produce the 101, pocket the 1, and then you have, this will be 4,500, not 5,000. Okay? This is an illogical situation. Violates the conditions of the problem. So therefore, total costs always have to go up, even by a little bit. The economies of large-scale production do not apply to total cost, they apply to average total cost, which is very different. It's total cost per unit that goes down for large-scale production, not total cost period. So this always is going up from the point of origin, which is zero, on up. So then the business firm has got to pick the maximum profit point. The maximum profit point will be the largest distance between total revenue and total cost, say that. Or this. Okay. And the conditions for it, this is what gets in all the average and marginal stuff which the textbooks are filled with. The conditions for, say, take this as the maximum distance between total revenue and total cost. Okay. Those of you who have taken differential calculus will immediately begin to see the analogies here. At this point, there's a maximum difference between these two. The tangent of the slope will be equal. The tangents between of this of total cost curve and the total revenue curve will be the same at this maximum distance. This is the the tangent. It's delta change in TR divided by delta Q. Okay. And this is change in TC. Divided by delta Q. This is also known as marginal revenue. The change in total revenue, whether increase or decrease, with one more unit of quantity is the marginal revenue, and the change in total cost, which of course is always going up, remember, with one more unit of cost, the marginal cost, where these two things are, the slope is the same, the marginal revenue and marginal cost are equal. This is the famous marginal revenue and marginal cost criterion. All it's really saying is, it's not saying anything else than the total revenue, the total profits are maximized. In other words, with this kind of curves, this is maximized when, this is profits, this is maximized when marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. And MR is delta TR over delta Q, MC is delta TC over delta Q. When the change is infinitely, this is where differential calculus comes in, when the change is infinitesimally small, then this becomes first derivative, dtr versus over dq, etc. Unfortunately, in human action, you don't have infinitesimally small steps. Therefore, calculus is really illegitimate in this situation. However, this is my gripe with mathematical economics in general. But this is where this thing comes from. With the taking infinitely small steps, it will get then its first derivative, delta dtr, marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. But you're not saying anything more, notice. You're not saying anything more of interest than simply you're trying to maximize profit. This is a criterion for maximizing profit. That's all there is to it. This is a whole shtick. Millions of words are wasted in economics works on this whole topic. Another problem with this is once you realize there might be more than one peak, this could also be a minimum. Okay, this could also identify a minimum point, minimum profit point, or it could be another maximum. So which is better? You can only find out which is better, which is minimum, which is maximum by inspecting the total. You're back to the total again. Minimum. So the marginal stuff really misleads you more than anything else. So it's an interesting way of looking at it. It's sort of in many ways helpful to show what's going on. That you're interested in each step of the way of making a profit. That your marginal revenue is at least greater or at least no less than the marginal cost for any decision, economic business decision. You want to make sure you're taking in at least as much as you're paying out. Hopefully, of course, more. But the main point is that the total is really the key. The key is you're trying to make total profits. The rest of the stuff is you can see how the mathematical economists get wrapped up in this. They get fascinated by the tangencies, by slopes, and all that sort of stuff. But it's really all subordinate to the main problem. Businessman cares about profits and losses. He doesn't really care about the other stuff. And this is why when economists talk to businessmen, they'll break down a communication. What do you mean by marginal? They don't understand what marginal cost is, marginal. And for good reason. Most of it is a lot of frippery, I would say. Useless frippery on the main topic. At any rate, so if you have more than, especially as I say, if you have more than one peak, you can get into big trouble by only talking about marginal because it could easily be a minimal profit. And so you have to, the only way to make sure by looking at the actual totals. So the whole point here is to say maximize total revenue minus total cost, and the equality of marginal revenue and marginal cost is a interesting property of a maximal profit situation. this gives us our marginal revenue and marginal cost. Marginal revenue is delta TR over delta Q. And when delta Q is 1, of course, it becomes very easy to look, just delta TR. And marginal cost is delta TC over delta Q. Let's see. The other thing, the average comes in, again, it's fairly simple now. The average revenue is TR over Q. It's the average revenue per unit. Average revenue per unit produced. That's the same thing as price. In other words, if you're selling 5 cases of widgets at $5,000, you're selling $1,000 per case. That's what price is. This is our demand curve, in other words. Same thing as, remember, P times Q is equal to TR. So average revenue is the same thing as price. That's where it all fits in. This is why you have these two curves, the total revenue curve here and the average revenue curve, which is the demand curve, right? Price and quantity. Average cost is total cost divided by quantity. This is average total cost, I should say, because I know talk about average fixed cost and average variable, it's all nonsense. The average total cost is total cost divided by quantity. In other words, if you spend $1 million and produce 100 units or something, the cost is $100,000 per unit. $10,000 per unit. In other words, you divide the total cost by unit. Its average total cost often falls spectacularly with large-scale production. Not the total, but the average total. The total cost per unit. Okay. All right. This is enough for you to absorb this time. We'll continue on with this stuff and on Thursday, and I give you back your exams.